administration. And the Russians see it. They have satellites. And they know what it means when somebody walks into the house and points a gun at every member of the family. And they decided it's time to fight back, that they had an opportunity to prepare their defenses, and they are countering offensive capabilities to a point where they could win a war if they had to. They didn't seek the war.
Sir, John DeBar, I'm really sorry to cut you off because we're fresh out of time. I do apologize for that. But thank you very much, Don DeBar, activist and commentator from Austin, New York. Thank you so much, Don. And Marcus Papadopoulos, a pleasure, historian, political analyst, and author from London. With that, we come to the end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Batagway and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now, we enlighten you with verses 40 to 43 of chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. يا بني إسرائيل اذكروا نعمتي التي أنعمت عليكم وأوفوا بعهدي أوف بعهدكم وَأَوْفُوا بِعَهْدِي أُوفِ بِعَهْدِكُمْ وَإِيَّايَ فَارْهَبُونِ وَآمِنُوا بِمَا أَنزَلْتُ مُصَدِّقًا لما معكم ولا تكونوا أول كافر به ولا تشتروا بآياتي ثمنا قليلا وإياي فاتقون وَلَا تَلْبِسُوا الْحَقَّ بِالْبَاطِلِ وَتَكْتُمُوا الْحَقَّ وَأَنْتُمْ تَعْلَمُونَ. وَأَقِيمُوا الصَّلَاةَ وَآتُوا الزَّكَاةَ وَارْكَعُوا مَعَ الرَّاكِعِينَ. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. O children of Israel, call to mind my favor which I bestowed on you, and be faithful to your covenant with me. I will fulfill my covenant with you, and of me, me alone, should you be afraid. And believe in what I have revealed, verifying that which is with you, and be not the first to deny it, neither take a mean price in exchange for my communications, and me, me alone should you fear. And do not mix up the truth with the falsehood, nor hide the truth while you know it. And keep up prayer, and pay the poor rate, and bow down with those who bow down. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Thousands of people rally against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Tel Aviv, holding banners that read, "Together against fascism and apartheid." British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak calls for radical actions in his country's crisis-hit healthcare. And China lifts quarantine requirements for inbound travelers after nearly 3 years following last month's decision to end its zero-COVID policy. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Thousands of demonstrators have gathered in Tel Aviv to protest against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's new cabinet. The protesters held banners that read "Together against fascism and apartheid" and "Prime Minister." The protesters also denounced judicial reforms proposed by the new justice minister. Opposition parties say that the proposed judicial reforms allow parliament to override decisions of the Supreme Court. Netanyahu, who is fighting corruption charges, took office late last month, and his new cabinet is regarded as the most right-wing in Israeli history. Israel revokes entry permits for three senior officials from the Fatah party after they visited the longest-serving Palestinian prisoner following his release. The three Palestinian officials had visited Karim Yunis in his home village of Ara in Haifa district. Israel said the decision was made after the three men took advantage of their status. The regime also said that the decision is part of Israel's response to the Palestinian Authority's decision to wage political and legal war against Tel Aviv by initiating an anti-Israeli motion at the UN. This a week after the UN General Assembly adopted a resolution calling on the International Court of Justice to comment on Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories. Western media and governments have been accusing the Syrian government of using chemical weapons against its own citizens in the war against terrorists, an allegation Damascus has always denied. Now the UAE ambassador to the UN accuses certain states of politicizing the Syrian chemical weapons case. We discuss this in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Welcome to our Barnup News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Now, United Arab Emirates ambassador to the UN has accused certain states of politicizing a Syrian chemical weapons file. Lana Zaki Nusseibeh has severely criticized attempts made by certain countries to politicize a Syrian chemical weapons case. Nusseibeh asked all parties in the Security Council to professionally consider the matter in line with the non-politicization policy of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, despite Abu Dhabi's role in instigating the Syrian conflict by supporting foreign-backed militants and the spread of misinformation. The Emirati government has recently adopted a diplomatic approach to normalize ties with Tel Aviv. Western media and governments have repeatedly alleged the Syrian government used chemical weapons against its own citizens in the war against terrorists. That's why Syria surrendered its stockpile of chemical weapons in 2014 to a joint mission led by the U.S. and the OPCW. And now joining us for the program is Mr. Robert Fantina, author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. Hello, Mr. Robert Fantina. Hope you're safe and doing well. Now, Robert, my question to you, we've seen this accusation time and again that bodies at the UN are being manipulated for certain countries' gains, a lot of things that shouldn't be politicized, as we have seen with Iran and the nuclear watchdog. Now we're seeing with OPCW, time and again, actually, with Syria, and we've seen it in other places. Your initial thoughts on the story today?
Well, unfortunately, the United Nations has buckled under pressure from the United States for years on a variety of different issues, and this is only one of them, the politicizing the chemical weapons file regarding Syria. Now, we have to remember that just 4 years ago, in 2018, after the United States dropped a bomb in Syria for alleged chemical weapons use, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, said the United States had no evidence that Syria had used chemical weapons. And also we know that Syria surrendered its chemical weapons back in 2014. So this is something that has been brought up to, as you said, to politicize the situation, to damage the reputation of the Syrian government, and to continue the U.S. policy of destabilizing the Middle East.
All right, thank you, Robert. And Daniel, it seems like we got you on the program now. Welcome to the program. Daniel Shaw now and from the Answer Coalition joining us out of New York. Now, Daniel, I want to put that question to you. Should we be surprised that it's Abu Dhabi and not a U.S. adversary that's bringing this up, this very interesting story about talking about the politicization of a U.N. body?
The United States, since 2011, has done everything to isolate and punish and wage war against the Syrian people. They've used economic warfare, they've used psych ops, they've used Saudi mercenaries and other mercenaries from the Gulf kingdoms. This has been a brutal proxy war. And of course, they've used these buzzwords. With Iraq, it was weapons of mass destruction. With the Syrians, it's been chemical weapons. And they introduced these buzzwords. The country that's most bombed and pillaged, the United States, Republican, Democrat, unrelenting punishment of any country that gets out of line and escapes from their sphere of influence. The bombing of Panama, the invasion of Grenada, the all-out war against the Cuban people and the Venezuelan people. And these buzzwords about chemical weapons, what has the United States been dropping on the Vietnamese people through their proxy power, Israel, and the Palestinian people? If nothing more and nothing less than chemical weapons, no country has used more chemical weapons and bombs than the United States. So this is, again, the politicization of this issue. They already have 900 U.S. troops in Syria against the Syrian people's will. So how good, how encouraging to see different Middle Eastern countries trying to forge this pan-Arab unity, which hasn't existed now, that Nasserite vision of a pan-Arab world united against U.S. imperialism.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program. Mr. Daniel Shaw from the Answer Coalition, they're joining us from New York, and Robert Fantina, author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. That is, pardon. That brings us to the conclusion of your news review program. Thank you for joining us, and bye-bye for now.
One person is killed after Russia resumes bombing of eastern Ukrainian regions, ending a self-declared ceasefire along the front line that lasted 36 hours. The death was from a shelling that hit the northern region of Kharkiv. Ukrainian officials also reported explosions across the border of Donbass region, which has been the front line for months. The truce was announced by Moscow for Orthodox Christmas celebrations that fell on Saturday, but Kiev rejected the ceasefire. The Kremlin now says Moscow will push ahead with the war until victory is achieved. The UK Prime Minister calls for radical actions to reform Britain's crisis-hit healthcare system. Rishi Sunak made the remarks in an emergency meeting with the British health leaders. He said bold moves should be taken, like the ones during the COVID pandemic, to resolve the crisis. The meeting comes as the UK is witnessing a rare strike by health workers who want a salary hike at a time when inflation has soared to record levels in the country. Britain has faced a wave of industrial action over the last few months, with strikes crippling various sectors. The government is planning to introduce a new law that would make it harder for key workers to strike. John Ross is a senior fellow at Chungyang Institute, and he's sharing his views with us about the way the UK government is responding to the protests and strikes by workers across the country.
It's one of a series of authoritarian government measures that they're taking. They've introduced very draconian rights on the right of people to peacefully demonstrate, for example. And then you have the harassment of anybody, of very severe punishment, as with, for example, Assange, of anybody who brings out the truth about what the Western governments are up. And it's because they're meeting increasing resistance for their population, and it shows what the character of Western so-called democracy was. As provided you were discussing something which didn't matter, you had free speech. You know, if we wanted to discuss whether traffic lights should be red, yellow and green, or we should change the color to purple or something, doubtless they'd allow free speech on it. But if you have something which actually affects the real situation, then it's clamped down upon. It shows the shallow, hollow sham which Western democracy actually is. And it is indeed increasing authoritarianism. It's one of the most severe cases, but it's very far from being the only case that's going on at the present time.
All European countries are struggling with inflation, but the problem has been more acute in Italy. The inflation rate in 2022 was the highest since 1985, and now Italians are very worried about soaring prices. Max Civilli reports from Rome.
The inflation rate in Italy has been high for a while, breaking record after record. An increasing number of Italians are struggling to make ends meet, fearing that the cost of living pinch could soon turn into pain. The National Bureau of Statistics recently announced that the prices in the country rose more than 8% year-on-year in 2022, jumping to its highest 12-month gain in 37 years.
It is impossible to continue this way. Gas and electricity bills have more than doubled, and the cost of bread and milk is going mad. This is pure madness.
Italy's annual inflation rate in December dropped to 11.6%, down from 11.8% in November, but the cost of living crisis keeps biting businesses and households hard. High energy prices caused by energy supply challenges that followed the Ukraine-Russia war is the main factor contributing to this surge.
The immediate loss of this situation has been the collapse of purchasing power by over 10%, which translates to the net loss of one monthly payment for employed workers. People on low-income wages, such as employees and workmen, which represents 90% of the labour force, are among those suffering the most.
Analysts believe that a combination of high inflation, rising interest rates and a lack of fiscal support will push Italy and other EU economies into recession.
You miss it, well.
Month after month, life is becoming increasingly tough. My retirement payment went up 50 euros 2 months ago, but the cost of living has increased by 200 euros each month.
Life is more expensive for those who live on one income only. The cost of renting houses, buying clothes for our kids, food. I can't see how we'll be able to face all this.
With the aim to fight high inflation and put prices under control, the European Central Bank has raised interest rates. The move is likely to hamper the European economy further. Some ministers in the Italian government have strongly criticized the ECB over its aggressive monetary policy that they believe could raise the prospect of recession. Max Civili, Rome.
China has officially ended its quarantine requirements for inbound travelers after nearly 3 years, despite struggling with a nationwide surge of COVID cases. All travelers are still required to test negative, that is, for COVID-19, within 48 hours of departure. Mainland China has opened its borders with Hong Kong. Beijing last month began a dramatic dismantling of a hardline zero-COVID strategy, and that involves mandatory quarantines and grueling lockdowns. The containment policy has generated resentment throughout China and led to nationwide protests before it was eased. Hundreds of Rohingya refugees in India are still deprived of proper shelter as freezing weather, hits parts of the country. The poor community now has to face both the terrible weather conditions and also acute sickness spreading among its members. Munawar Zaman reports.
It's afternoon, and many Rohingya women are waiting in a queue to receive blankets offered by an NGO. Some are angry since they haven't received any blankets yet. Over the last few days, northern India has had freezing weather, and that has heaped misery of homelessness for the refugees living in makeshift tents. Zahid Hussain has come out of his shanty to have some sunlight. He says he's worried as his child has developed a skin disease that's getting worse and worse. He asked me to come to his shanty, where he is living with his family in appalling conditions.
My child is very sick. He got some skin disease. God knows what it is. But doctors say it's chickenpox or measles. He is very irritated due to uneasiness of skin. The day starts with his sickness, and all day long it's silently killing him with fevers and chills. Once a doctor from some NGO came here and gave medicine, but nothing worked.
Activists say such treatment of the community is against the Indian ethos of Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which translates to the world is one family. In recent years, a vicious expulsion campaign has shed more light on the way India treats specific communities. Rights activists have been urging the government to adopt a uniform refugee policy which treats refugees equally, regardless of their faith or ethnicity. Thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are braving the cold weather and live in makeshift tents across the Indian subcontinent. These people, who always face the threat of detention and deportation, are here struggling for survival.
In this camp, children are getting sick and the sickness is unusual. They are getting chills, vomiting and fever. We have never seen this skin disease before. Even after visiting the doctor, the children are not getting any better. In every family, you will find children with this sickness. Now even women and men are getting affected. It's a very dangerous situation. Some say the sickness is spread to other camps. Doctors have advised us not to have guests from other camps and not to visit them.
Many refugees I spoke with shared heart-wrenching stories with me, and most of them kept asking why their voice is not being heard in the age of technology. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports suggest the real figure stands at hundreds of thousands. Rohingya Muslims are being treated as illegal immigrants in India and elsewhere after fleeing Myanmar. Activists in India have stressed the urgent need to protect the Rohingyas' rights as refugees. Munawar Zaman, in the outskirts of New Delhi.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
The Limelight.
A new survey has shown that economists consider the probability of recession in the United States to approximately 70% in 2023. Also, nearly 9 out of 10 Americans are worried about economic recession, while two-thirds of voters believe the country's economy is in recession. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Hill newspaper has covered the story. According to a survey conducted by the National Association of Manufacturers, 62% of manufacturers expect the U.S. economy to enter a recession this year. The survey also found that 69% of manufacturers have a positive outlook for their company, the lowest figure since the third quarter of 2020. They cited struggles in attracting and finding workers, continued supply chain problems, and high raw material costs. It's the latest warning sign that the U.S. manufacturing industry is slowing down amid weakening demand and higher borrowing costs stemming from the Federal Reserve's interest rate hikes. The Institute for Supply Management said on Wednesday, 4th of January, that manufacturing contracted for the second straight month in December and reached its weakest point since May of 2020. To add insult to injury, some of manufacturers' top priorities fell flat at the end of last Congress, including changes to taxes, permitting and immigration policy. Congress refused to scrap new rules implemented this year as part of Republicans' 2017 tax bill that require companies to spread out their research and development tax deductions over 5 years rather than write them off immediately. Large manufacturers, including Ford and Boeing, lobbied lawmakers to reverse the new rules, warning that they would lead to layoffs. Lawmakers also rejected a proposal from Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, to streamline the permitting process for energy projects, a top priority for manufacturers that drew opposition from many environmental groups. The National Association of Manufacturers president and CEO, Jay Timmons, said in a statement, "Much-needed permitting reforms and provisions to strengthen our ability to conduct research and development, buy machinery and finance job-creating investments, which we need to promote growth within the sector, were left on the cutting room floor last year." The National Association of Manufacturers survey was conducted from 29th of November through to 13th of December and received 337 responses. The Wall Street Journal has also covered the same story. According to a new survey, two-thirds of economists at the largest U.S. financial institutions believe a recession will occur in 2023. The survey of 23 primary dealers, the large financial firms that do business directly with the U.S. Federal Reserve, found the majority expect a recession in the coming year. Among the top economic concerns cited included dwindling personal savings, the decline in the housing market, and tightening lending standards at many banks. It follows the U.S. Federal Reserve's rapid rate interest rate hikes to battle soaring inflation last year, which saw the benchmark rate rise from near zero in March to a range of 4.25% to 4.5% by the end of the year. The central bank forecast that will reach a range of 5% to 5.25% by the end of 2023. Its forecast doesn't call for a rate cut before 2024. The U.S. Federal Reserve policy rate is now at its highest level since prior to the 2008 recession, as the central bank attempts to bring inflation down without triggering an economic downturn. By the Fed's preferred measure, inflation is still running nearly three times its 2% goal, having risen earlier in 2022 at its fastest pace in the past 40 years. Rising prices have forced consumers to rapidly spend down savings, which soared during the COVID-19 pandemic thanks to stimulus measures and a slowdown in spending. The personal saving rates dropped to 2.4% in November, far below the pre-pandemic average of 8.8% in 2019. Consumers have also increasingly been tapping lines of credit to make ends meet. According to US Federal Reserve data, total household borrowing reached $16.51 trillion in the third quarter, a $351 billion increase from the prior quarter and 8.3% jump from a year ago, the fastest annual increase in the past 14 years. Higher interest rates have had the most dramatic impact on the housing market, which saw a plunge in sales activity in the second half of last year. The 30-year fixed rate mortgage breached 7% in October for the first time since 2002, more than doubling in the span of 9 months. It has deflated a red-hot housing market fueled by historically low borrowing costs and a rush to the suburbs during the pandemic. According to the National Association of Realtors, existing home sales fell 7.7% in November from October, and November sales dropped a whopping 35.4% year over year. The National Association of Realtors added that the current 10-month streak of declines is the longest on record in the data that dates back to 1999. Banks have also tightened their lending standards in recent months, a traditional leading indicator of recession. The British newsletter The Financial Times has also reported on the same story. A top International Monetary Fund official said inflation in the United States has not turned a corner yet, and it is too early for the Federal Reserve to declare victory in the fight on rising prices. Geeta Gopinath, a deputy managing director of the fund, urged the U.S. Central Bank to press ahead with rate rises this year. She said it was important for the Federal Reserve to maintain restrictive monetary policy until a very definite, durable decline in inflation was evident in wages and industries not related to food or energy. She added, "If you see the indicators in the labor market and if you look at very sticky components of inflation like services inflation, I think it's clear that we haven't turned the corner yet on inflation." The comments follow recent data showing that job openings, closely watched as a proxy for labour market shortages and pressure on employers to hand out wage increases higher than normal, fell only moderately in the month of November in the United States. Minutes of the US Federal Reserve's December 13-14 policy meeting, published on Wednesday, 4th of January, showed that officials agreed that the central bank now needed to balance its fight against price pressures with the risk of slowing down the economy too much. In October, the International Monetary Fund cut its outlook for global economic growth in 2023, reflecting the continuing drag from the Ukraine war, as well as inflation pressure and higher interest rates engineered by central banks to rein in those price pressures.
IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens and break it down from a Muslim perspective. On today's show, we'll analyse what might be behind the suspicious murder of an Iranian Sunni imam who was found dead after initially being kidnapped earlier this month in southeastern of the Islamic Republic. So who was Molavi Abdul Vahid Righi and why was he killed? This next report will shed some light on this upsetting episode.
An Iranian Sunni cleric was kidnapped and murdered by unknown assailants in early December amid ongoing Western-backed anti-Iran violence across the country. Molavi Abdul Wahid Righi was the Friday prayers leader of Imam Hussein Mosque in Khash, a southeastern county in Sistan and Balochistan province. Local forces had been mobilized to find the whereabouts of the cleric, but his dead body was found not long after his disappearance on a roadside with three bullet wounds to the head. Prior to his death, Molavi Righi expressed strong support for the Islamic Republic of Iran and admitted his views earned him death threats. Iranian authorities have issued warnings against enemy plots aimed at destabilizing Sistan and Balochistan, a region home to many Sunni Muslims. Sectarianism is a tried and tested tactic used by the West to destroy Muslim countries who fail to submit to Western political hegemony. Iran may be facing the same challenge. Meanwhile, the violence has claimed the lives of dozens of people and members of security forces, while also allowing terrorist attacks across the country.
Well, joining us in the studio today are two esteemed guests. The first is Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, a UK-based Muslim scholar and lecturer who studied inside Iran for many years, and Masood Shajaray, the head of the London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me on the show today. Masood, I'm going to come straight to you on this because you may have met the martyred Maulana a few times in the past. Could you just start off by telling me what your impression was of the man?
Yes, he was well known as a scholar and someone who supports the concept of unity and the Islamic Republic foundation and the leadership. He was receiving a lot of death threats and the pressures from external sources and so forth, but he really was one of those exceptional scholars, Sunni scholars, who was not only believing in it, but was extremely vocal in his support. And in reality, I think we need to understand that this is the position of overwhelming majority of Sunnis within Iran. I was in Qesh last year, and when I went around and I saw the sort of reflection of the unity, you know, there were Shia mosque, Sunni mosque, Adhan, few sort of minutes in different timing. But, you know, people, and when you talk to people, everybody wasn't seeing what the problem is. And Qeshm is one of those areas where it's almost 50-50. And people were articulating to me that they intermarried. They really didn't see problem there. the problem seems to be more something is a creation of an image that is created outside by sort of individual sort of agents and those who actually want to create disunity. And we know that divide and rule is one of the things colonials have done and used as effectively over years and years.
Do you think that that's what we're seeing happening now in the south, east of the country? You think that perhaps there's some kind of attempt to divide Sunnis and Shias?
Oh, this has been going on since the beginning of the revolution. I mean, if you look at how many anti-Shia books were before the revolution, you hardly could see it. You know, there was probably one or two. When you look at the Ikhwan al-Muslimin sort of leadership, there was always Shia and Sunni sort of representation, even at that level. But what we are seeing now after the revolution, there were books after books after books being published in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, pumping this sort of idea of these are others, they're not one of us. And I remember in UK, I was running and were involved in running of a mosque. And as everybody knows, I've come from a Shia background. But the mosque was actually a Sunni mosque. And I was the vice president of it in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And we were going around trying to find Qurans from different places. And when we went and approached, Central Mosque and other places in London to get some Qurans, we couldn't find Qurans. But they were actually willing to give us tons and tons of books which are sectarian promotion. So really that was happening just very clearly, and you could see it so clearly, and that has continued since then till now and has become more sophisticated.
For sure. Sheikh Hanif, let me bring you in on this discussion, because again, you've been to Iran, you know perhaps what it's really like there behind the negative headlines which we've seen circulating around. Last episode, we discussed the fact that there are anti-Iran protests going on right now, but it seems like this assassination of a minority religious leader is something different here. What's your impression of what's going on in Iran right now?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I don't think it's different. I think, first of all, you know, it's a natural human tendency to love each other. That's the most powerful tendency, right? You know, people of different ethnic groups, racial groups, religious groups, and so on, living together normally, all right, they will build bridges with each other. The differences or hostility between these groups always come from the outside and always come from people who find, or communities or countries or whatever, or political interests and so forth, that find it important for you to have a division in order to control for their benefit. Okay? As Brother Mahsoud, correctly stated, before the Islamic Revolution, you know, you would hardly find anti-Shia books in the Sunni community. Okay? After the Islamic Revolution, which is calling for the Muslims to overthrow Western imperialist domination, okay, you find a plethora of anti-Shia books in the community, and even anti-Sunni type of things also appearing in the Sunni community by those people who are partners in that project. Okay, so that project is not, it will exploit both sides. Now, when we are talking about the Mahsa Amini thing, all right, it is quite interesting that, first of all, yes, you had this anti-Shia stuff going on and a lot of infiltration into Iran and so on. But you also find it coincides with the Russia-Ukraine war, you know, and the fact that Iran is supporting Russia, you see, in this. And if you see the increased intensity, right? For example, in places like Pakistan, making almost extortionate demands on countries in Africa and Asia and so forth to force people to take a side on this, you see this Mahsa Amini thing started to ramp up. Mm. Okay. So I think the assassination of Shahid Rig and, the Mahsa Amini thing and the Russia-Ukraine aspect, all of these things are coming together. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And with respect to Iran, they're using classical, I don't know if you'd call it soft power or regime change by stoking what are not really divisions, but could potentially be divisions in a society. For example,
they're
divisions
looking for wiggle room, somewhere to exploit.
Divisions in belief, male female type of things. You know, youth, older generation things, right? Mm. All of these things are natural sort of like, not really divisions, but, categories in society, if one could call it that, you see?
Potential areas to exploit that. Use the economy to their benefit, that type
of
thing.
Exactly.
Yes, you know? For sure.
So I think, people who are, cognizant of the trends of history would be able to pick that up.
Now, Masoud, before we move on to the next segment, you've got about a minute left or so. I want to ask you, we don't actually know. I think there's been some arrests made, but they're still investigating who conducted this assassination. Could you perhaps give your opinion on who potentially could be behind it? What are the anti-Iran groups that are active at the moment?
Well, really, to pinpoint who did it at the name and so forth, it is difficult. That's security forces thing. But it's obvious that those who are threatening him, those who actually want to create this conflict, those who want to create this otherization, that separation, as the brother said, those are the ones behind it. What they seem to be concentrating on is to turn Iran to another Libya, to another Syria. And for that, any division, any conflict, is actually is picked up and amplified. And this amplification is also seen more outside, like Syria and Libya, seen more outside than inside. But also I think what is important for people inside to recognize is that the lives of everyone in Libya, in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan was shattered through this intervention and conflict creation. Of the West, and which has served no one except the weapon manufacturers and the State of Israel to have a conflict in the whole region.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, for your opinion so far. We are going to come back to the discussion. But first, let's take a moment to browse through some online opinions and reactions to the shocking and disturbing news of the scholar's assassination. We have a tweet coming here which says, all praise be to Allah and to Muhammad and his blessed family. May God preserve the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is from Abu Muhammad 16, who adds that His Eminence, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, and all of those who are working vigilantly to protect the Islamic Republic, Godspeed to them. We have another tweet coming in from Ashraf as well, who gives a very strong opinion. He makes a very valid point, saying that may his soul be rest in peace. It's tragic how the enemies of Islam and peace despise Muslim unity. Remember, Martin Luther King was supposedly ready to unite with Malcolm X. All of a sudden, there was an assassination attempt, a very valid point, I think, which can be used to compare perhaps what's happening here in Iran. Let's move on to Rahul now, who comes in with another strong opinion, who adds that he makes very, very clear that they should arrest all of these terrorists, do whatever they have to in order to resolve the situation. These terrorists want to turn Iran into another Libya or Syria. And finally, let's move over to an opinion coming in from JJ, again on Twitter, who says, killed by those looking to turn Shia and Sunni against one another for political gain. Just think who would gain from that. Sectarianism is a tried and tested tactic used by Western powers to divide and rule the Muslim world. That's absolutely clear. This next report touches on how and why these tactics have been successful in the past and used to weaken the Ummah so much.
Western colonialists have long sought to drive a wedge between Sunnis and Shias across the Muslim world as a means to divide and weaken the Muslims. And this is also the case in Iran, which has a large minority of Sunni Muslims living within its borders. Sunni Islam and Shia Islam are the two great Islamic orthodoxies which comprise the vast majority of the Muslim Ummah. Sunnis believe that the Prophet's companion, Abu Bakr, Umar and Uthman were his rightful successors, where Shias believe that the Prophet's son-in-law and cousin Ali should have been his heir. At first, the differences between the two Islamic strands were simply political, but they later developed some theological differences too. That said, the commonalities between the two main strands of Islam are far greater than their differences, and Sunnis and Shias have largely coexisted in harmony throughout Islamic history. Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has repeatedly emphasized the need for Islamic unity so that the Ummah can successfully revive. He has also repeatedly said that Shias must not harm the sanctities of the Sunnis. But despite this, the imperialists and Takfiris are trying to falsely claim Iran is anti-Sunni, with the ultimate goal of weakening the Islamic Republic.
Well, let's head back to our guest discussion now, and I'm going to bring in Sheikh Hanif once again. Tell me, you was in Iran for many, many years. You know what it's really like there. There seems to be this misconception pushed sometimes that Iran is like this Shia majority country, which is intolerant to its Sunni minority. And I've heard things like there are no Sunni mosques in Tehran, for example. Could you just clarify if that's the case or not?
I have traveled quite extensively in the south of Iran, where a lot of the Sunni population is concentrated. I've also been to Kurdistan, which is quite majority Sunni. And I see on the community level, there is no hostility. There's intermarriage. You know, Sunnis have their own masajid. You know, Shias could come in there and pray. They have their own madrasas, okay, that are independent, you know. And you don't see on the social level any kind of tension, you know. I wouldn't doubt that you would have probably elements that might be sectarian. I think this is something that occurs in religious communities by and large. You know, there might be people who might have these types of tendencies, but you don't. When I was there, they were not dominant as an idea in the community. Yeah. So I really don't see a problem. You know, the same was like in Iraq, for example. In Iraq, you know, you had Sunnis and Shias getting married and so on. As soon as, the Americans want to take over the oil and so forth, then you find a propagation of anti-Sunni, anti-Shia stuff going on in Iraq. Hmm. You know, people who were married, you know, families were broken up and so on. And I think, you know, basically when you find these types of phenomena, you have to ask the question, who has the most to benefit from this? You know, I would always, always go back to basically Western and American interests.
And Masood, I want to ask you again, you know Iran very, very well. Do you think that Iran is perhaps vulnerable to the same type of sectarianism push from the West as, say, other countries in the region have been, like Iraq, for example?
When I went to Qish last year, even I was surprised the level of the unity on the grassroots. I mean, you know, talking to the taxi driver, talking to people around the city, you know, I was so conscious to find out what is really going on that level, because, you know, any other level could be manipulated. And people genuinely were saying, we don't have a problem. There are efforts to create these problems, but we are united. We are so sort of almost together, you know, bonded together. But there are elements, you know, I mean, look, in Iraq, what happened, I remember two British soldiers dressed up in Arab clothes were arrested, armed to the teeth with bombs, and they were arrested. What do you think they were doing? You know, if you go to one community and dressed up as that community and bomb the other side, and then next day go to the other community and bomb the opposite side, even if there are people two sides of same street and have no other difference other than that, they start fighting each other because they see people from that side of the street that are attacking this side and from this side to that side. So it's easy to create that. And I've been involved. We have a program called Charter 3103, which is from the verses of Quran, At-tasmu bihamdillahi jami'an. We go for conflict resolution. We have done this settings in Pakistan, in Indonesia, in Malaysia, and it's been extremely successful, bringing people from the Salafi background, from Sufi background, from Shia background. And when you put people together over a few days, praying together, eating together, joking together, and so forth, you see the bonding. And, you know, people going through that process usually come back and they say, look, before we used to go to studio of TV studios and we used to really go for each other. Now, we're ashamed of doing that. Mm. We actually cannot go for each other that way because on the level of heart being brought together. And I think the verse is actually deals with that. It's not a political unity. Allah says, unite. And do you remember the times that you were separate from one another? Then I brought your hearts together. Mm-hmm. So we need to unite on the level of heart, on the level of, you know, brotherhood and so forth. And I think the other really important thing is that the creative illusion, and I've seen it. I was giving a talk once, and a brother from a Salafi background got up. He said, what you're saying about unity is fantastic, but it's impossible. Mm. I told him that, well, look, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala orders us to unite. Do you think Allah is joking with us? They're asking us to do something which is impossible? Mm. The impossibility is being put in our brain. It's not the reality.
Wow.
It is possible, and we need to work on it, and we need to get rid of these illusions that the enemy is creating to divide us.
That's a very strong story to end your point on. I'm going to come back to you, Sheikh, on this and ask you about this concept of Islamic unity. I think right now we do live in an age where there does seem to be a divide between Muslim communities on many issues. Sectarianism to a degree perhaps has been partly successful, but do you think that this concept of Islamic unity is possible, and if so, how can we get there?
I don't think it's possible. I think it's natural. It's not just possible, it's natural. I mean, when you look at the history of Islam, okay, you never found a situation. You very rarely would you find a situation where people are forced to convert to Islam, you know, in contradiction to Western propaganda. Okay? In fact, what you would find that in the Christian countries, okay, you had more intolerance, okay, than in Muslim countries for other religions, not to mention other Muslim sects or points of view, okay? So when you look at, for example, classical Spain and Al-Andalus, which was Islamic country, a 100% Islamic country that was close to 800 years. When you look at the golden age in Iraq, you know, you find a confluence of different thought, Christian philosophy, Buddhist philosophy, you know, Pahlavi philosophy and the sciences and so forth. Everybody was free. You found that some of the greatest advances in traditional Jewish thought was under Maimonides, you know, who was living in Islamic Spain and had that freedom to do this.
Yes, that's okay? Right.
Okay, all right. So when you could have that type of unity with other religions and cultures, you know, what about between Islam, you know, between Muslims, you see? When you look at the Christian world, however, you know, you have things like the 100-year war, you know, between Christians. You know, you had Christians slaughtering each other.
The Dark Ages, I think, were during the Islamic Golden Age, wasn't it?
You know, when they retook Andalus, You know, you had blood flowing in the streets from Jews and Christians. When the Jews were fleeing this persecution, where did they go? Did they go north to Germany? No, man, they went south to Morocco because they knew Muslims would be tolerant towards them. This whole new idea of Muslim intolerance and so forth is actually fomented by these puppets of the West. Saudi Arabia, for example. Elements within these countries and so forth. So I think we have to be able to be cognizant of history to be able to understand these things.
Gentlemen, thank you for joining me. Unfortunately, we are out of time. There's so much more we could have discussed, but we'll have to leave it there for the time being. And thank you to everyone at home for joining us for this edition of Eye on Islam. But for now, it's Assalamu Alaikum.
In the limelight.
The U.S. so-called law enforcement has killed at least 1,176 people, or about 100 people a month last year, making it the deadliest for police violence. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote in this regard, law enforcement officers killed an average of 3 people per day, but faced more violence in the line of duty. Cops in the U.S. killed 1,176 people in 2022, making last year the deadliest on record, according to a nonprofit group that tracks police violence. However, officers faced more attempts on their own lives as crime in some cities soared to new heights. Mapping Police Violence, a project connected to the Black Lives Matter movement, found that police fatally shot, beat, tased, and restrained 31 more people last year than in 2021, when they killed 1,145 people. 2022's